Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. Today, we're turning back the clock to explore one of the most transformative forces of the 18th century, the power of print. It's a story of ink-stained hands, pamphlet wars, and revolutionary rhetoric. The year is 1774. Virginia's revolutionary leaders are gathering in Williamsburg, grappling with how to resist British oppression. Meanwhile, 31-year-old Thomas Jefferson, sidelined by illness, pens a radical pamphlet, a summary view of the rights of British America. But Jefferson's fiery ideas may never have reached a wider audience without Clementina Rind, a trailblazing printer in Williamsburg. Today, we'll unpack how Clementina's press gave life to Jefferson's words, and we'll explore the power of print in spreading revolutionary ideas. We're joined by James Herrera Brooks, the Melanie Trent DeShutter Senior Director of Research and Publications at the VMHC, and Kathy Hellier, Senior Historian at Colonial Williamsburg. Before we talk about Clementina Rind and Thomas Jefferson's pamphlet, let's set the scene. We know the American colonies were a hotbed of revolutionary ideas in the 1770s, but how do these ideas spread? The answer lies in a marriage of literacy, print culture, and the spoken word. The Enlightenment primed the colonies for new ways of thinking, emphasizing reason, experimentation, and the pursuit of knowledge. These intellectual currents fueled a growing belief that society and government could be improved through new ideas.
I think something that's foundational to think about as we begin to consider communication and the transmission of ideas is the kind of foundational role that the Enlightenment plays in the 17th and 18th centuries. This is essentially conceiving of a range of social ideas by valuing knowledge, reasoning, rationalism, and empiricism, which is the idea that true knowledge comes from experience and empirical evidence. That leads us to ask, well, why are these things important? So in a more abstract way, I think that that means that people across the Atlantic world and not just in the Americas are more interested in reason and in experimentation and new ideas. And there is truly a sense that problems in society and with government can be solved with new solutions. Ultimately, that's something that we're going to see in the way that American nationhood itself forms this kind of experiment in democracy in the 18th century. I think in a more direct way, developments in print culture, in learning and literacy are all encouraged by and in turn encourage Enlightenment thinking.
The Enlightenment laid the intellectual groundwork for revolutionary thought, but the spread of these ideas depended on another critical factor, literacy.
Literacy in the American colonies is exceptionally high. Some argue it was the highest in the world and certainly greater than you would find in England at the same time. While we don't have an exact knowledge of literacy rates during the Revolution, which can be hard to consult and estimate given the kind of scant nature of much of the evidence that would lead us to those conclusions, we can form impressions. So, for example, estimates of New England in 1760 have around 80% of white men being able to read and write. And this number is much lower for white women, who come in around 48%. These figures are lower across the South, but studies of the Williamsburg area put the number of literate white men at around 90%, and for white women, around 54%. In Virginia, more broadly, we're perhaps thinking something like 60% of white men across the colony, and perhaps 25% of white women. There's a study of white men in Middlesex County, which looks at the first half of the 18th century. And this estimates that just shy of about 60% of white men are able to read and write, but that the upper and middle classes, the literacy rate for those is actually essentially 100%. It's, of course, important to remember that these figures, of course, neglect Black Virginians, particularly enslaved Black Virginians, indigenous people, And the population of Virginia that is enslaved in this period is around 40%. Many of those individuals will be illiterate, but there are exceptions.
Caveat here. Defining literacy is kind of hard to do in this period. Does it mean you can read a certain number of words? Does it mean you can read and understand at a certain level? What's clear is that literacy varied widely, and importantly, the ability to read was often valued more than the ability to write. The high literacy rates amongst colonists created the perfect environment for revolutionary ideas to take root. To really understand how these ideas spread, we need to look at how people got their information, through things like printed materials as well as oration. Since most people were better at reading than writing, ideas were shared in easy-to-digest formats like pamphlets, newspapers, and broadsides. For those who couldn't read, sermons, public speeches, and even private conversations in homes and taverns brought these ideas to life. In the 18th century, printing was becoming much more efficient, with more presses in operation. The number of books printed in Europe nearly doubled, which meant that more books could be brought across the Atlantic to the colonies. And while the growth wasn't as dramatic in America, the jump was still significant. This explosion of print culture became a key way that people exchanged knowledge, shared ideas, and had access to information that everyone could reference.
Print culture, although it may seem slow and unresponsive to us in the present, it really represents the kind of cutting edge in communication and knowledge transmission. By the standards of the day, again, you know, kind of casting off our own conceptions of the period, it really allows for quicker, more responsive, and more accessible communication that's going to be able to reach greater swaths of society. We're so used to digital media in the present, but we really need to think about print culture as the kind of social media, the 24-hour TV and radio news cycle of the period. And that ultimately really represents a great change from what had come before. So if we think back 20 years from now in our present moment, when we think about how we were more dependent on newspapers, fixed news coverage, and while news was still available on the internet, but a much slower rate than we receive it now, we can kind of get a sense of just how transformative some of the innovations in print culture would have been to individuals in the period.
Let's talk about newspapers. Those things were literally everywhere. In Williamsburg, there were several competing newspapers, and some of them were even named the exact same thing. Looking at you, Virginia Gazette. But we'll talk more about that later.
It's important to think about these newspapers being something different to what we conceive of when we think about a modern day newspaper. So these were not illustrated other than perhaps a masthead that would be featured on the first page. They didn't feature loud headlines in the way that we think of. And so they're a lot denser in terms of the kind of material that you're getting out of them and perhaps a little less sensationalist, at least by our kind of judgment in the present. There are a huge number of newspapers in circulation during the American Revolution, and they really do work in terms of accessibility, not necessarily because they have huge subscriber lists or huge circulation. I think what's important to think about is rather than circulation, but the reach of these documents. So, for example, if you were to purchase a newspaper and that newspaper might have something like a subscriber list of maybe 600 individuals, it's not just being consumed by those 600 individuals. They'll be available in places like taverns, coffee houses. They're going to be read aloud in public spaces. They're going to be read aloud in private homes. And so when we think about the kind of amount of people that are actually able to access those documents, it does go beyond those who actually have the purchasing power to buy them.
As we mentioned, there are varying degrees of literacy in the colonies. So we also see the development of more types of visual communication. That could be something like a political cartoon with relatively little text, or something that's more of a shorter form written source, like a broadside. A broadside is essentially a document that features all of the information on one side, and that means it lends itself to being sort of a shorter public notice. It's something that could be fixed on a wall that is inside a social building, like a tavern or a coffee house, or something that could be pasted alongside the walls of a courthouse. Another relatively accessible form of print culture were pamphlets. These were incredibly powerful tools for shaping public opinion because they tended to be dedicated to one specific political issue. They were short, cheap, relatively easy to produce, and designed to be passed from hand to hand.
When people are gathering, they're able to kind of pick up information from those pieces of print culture, which are literally kind of dotting the landscape and not just kind of being passed around from hand to hand and read in kind of more private circumstances. Ultimately, you know, of course, it's those newspapers and those pamphlets that are considered the most responsive, that most easily reproducible, and that are really dominant in kind of spreading that revolutionary discourse.
We should also consider whose voices were amplified in print. Revolutionary print culture largely centered white male perspectives, but enslaved and free Black individuals also engaged with these ideas. Broadsides and speeches about liberty inevitably reached enslaved individuals, raising questions about their own status. So while the printers and writers we often hear about were white, the revolutionary ideas that they spread were heard and considered by Black individuals as well.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, Unbound. Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.
With the swell of print culture in the 18th century as the revolution edged nearer, taverns and coffee houses buzzed with discussion. Imagine a pamphlet being read aloud in a crowded tavern, its words sparking debates that carried messages far beyond the printed page. Spaces like Williamsburg's Raleigh Tavern became hubs of debate and decision-making.
So thinking about newspapers in particular, it was often kind of a communal activity. And so we think about the spaces in which those newspapers might be read and debated. We're thinking about places like coffee houses, which are, you know, kind of electrifying spaces where people are taking caffeine, they're discussing new ideas, they're getting excited about new ideas. Taverns, of course, with inebriation and drunkenness is going to lead to some pretty colorful debates and things like that. But ultimately, we're really having to kind of think about just that sheer circulation of the printed word, which is drawing upon these Enlightenment ideals, which really kind of push people to think about new solutions to present day problems. The best example of a kind of revolutionary space is going to be the Raleigh Tavern in Williamsburg, right? Particularly once Governor Dunmore dissolves the House of Burgesses, that's going to be a real key space for those revolutionary and more radical thinkers and Virginia leaders to meet and be able to kind of disseminate ideas. Ultimately, though, it's not going to be enough just to simply meet in those spaces and kind of orate on different ideas and be able to communicate through debate and discourse and things like mass communication over long distances. That cannot be achieved alone by these smaller, more intimate spaces. And that's where the importance of print culture really comes to the fore.
One of the most well-known examples of this is, of course, going to be Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which is published in 1776. It's read individually, read privately, and read aloud publicly. It called for improved government by praising the common sense of ordinary people, their reason, and their ability to make sound judgments. Ultimately, it's a direct call for independence, and its circulation was immense. For context, the population of the American colonies at this time was estimated at about 2.5 million, and Common Sense had the largest sale and circulation of any pamphlet in American history, proportionate to that population.
So ultimately, something like Common Sense is a direct call for independence. And if we think about that pamphlet's circulation, it really, really is vast. And this is not only in the Americas, it's not only in England, but it's truly around the Atlantic world in that period. The population of the American colonies at this period is estimated to be around 2.5 million, and Common Sense has the largest sale and circulation of any book or pamphlet printed in American history, judged by that proportion to population. So ultimately, it's things like common sense and newspapers which are tapping into revolutionary discourse that are essentially facilitating long-distance mass communication, right? So it's this idea that now you can be in a place like Williamsburg or be in the metropole in London, in England, and actually communicate ideas with people who might be hundreds, if not thousands, of miles away from you. So the idea that this print media is carrying new and revolutionary ideas and the fact that it can reach so many people and inform a different kind of way of thinking, different discourse, that's really what is helping kind of foment this opposition to British rule in the 18th century.
Now, if this all sounds a little bit too good to be true, there were some very real logistical challenges with this rise in print culture. Printing depended on a robust infrastructure. It required specialized equipment, which often was being imported from Europe, which is one challenge. They also needed to have the ability to turn wood into paper or purchase paper from somewhere else. They also needed skilled tradesmen or tradeswomen, as we'll see in the case of Clementina Rind a little bit later, to actually produce these printed materials. Another issue that comes into play is the idea of censorship. Censorship takes a lot of different forms, and there is a precedent for it in Virginia, with roughly 1,200 prosecutions for seditious speech happening in the 1600s.
Another way this comes into play, and this is particularly from the mid-century, there's a succession of printers who are seen as being too loyal to the governor, and this is people like William Parks and Joseph Royal. And the reason for this is not only are they printing their own Virginia Gazettes, but they are also actually in this very lucrative position as the colony's official printers. And so these men are getting very good salaries from the government, and therefore they're wedded to the business of government. And that's going to mean that they're going to avoid printing material that's considered inflammatory or radical because they essentially don't want to jeopardize their positions.
One Virginian at the time actually comments, and I can quote directly from this. They write, "It is well known that we are, in this colony, deprived of that great support of freedom, the liberty of the press. The only newspaper in Virginia is totally engrossed for the vile purpose of ministerial craft," which is embellishment in part, but certainly it reflects that idea that there are constraints on the press. Thomas Jefferson actually tries to reckon with this in the late 1770s. I think it's 1778 when he pushes for a bill, and it's titled the Bill for the More General Diffusion of Knowledge. It ultimately fails, but essentially the idea behind this is that an educated public is required to be able to keep power in check, right? So he's arguing that by providing access to information through better schooling, through more literacy, you're going to have an informed public who are able to pinpoint issues, potential tyranny, perceived tyranny in government, and actually be able to keep that power in check.
The story of print culture wouldn't be complete without highlighting individuals who defied convention. Let's talk about Clementina Rind, the woman whose press gave Jefferson's summary view its voice. Clementina was an exceptional woman in 18th century Virginia. We don't know much about Clementina's early life, but she was born sometime in the 1740s. We don't know if that was in Maryland or potentially in England before traveling across to the colonies. But we do know she married a man named William Rind, and they worked in Annapolis on a newspaper before moving to Williamsburg to set up a press.
William and Clementina moved to Virginia. They very originally set up their own newspaper with the title of the Virginia Gazette, which can be quite tricky for historians to kind of keep track of all these multiple, I think there's three or four Virginia Gazettes over the course of the 18th century, which were all being published and printed by different individuals. They overlap at times. Sometimes they are literally printing at the same time. And so they go into that work. They have success. The newspaper's popular because William, with the help of Clementina, is able to have a more balanced way of reporting the news and representing public opinion.
So the success of William Rind's Virginia Gazette eventually means that when the previous printer's tenure as the colony's public printer is over, and his name is Joseph Royal, Rind actually takes up that position.
Pause. What do we mean when we keep saying Virginia's public printer? The colony of Virginia had a variety of people who were printing a variety of materials, but the government of colonial Virginia contracted one specific person to act as the colony's official public printer. They were given a contract to print things like laws and government notices, but could also continue to print their own private materials.
So the position is taken up by Rhind. He unfortunately passes away after a brief illness. And this is where Clementina really steps up and steps in. So without skipping a beat, she prints the next issue of the Virginia Gazette. Clementina works with a relative of the family and also with a man called Dick, who is an enslaved man owned by the Rhind family. And the next issue of the newspaper is printed a week later. She also argues that she should be the one to kind of temporarily, through the end of William Rhind's tenure, take up that position as the colony's public printer. She successfully gets that position, which is incredibly important. I think the salary that that individual earns is something like 250 or 350 pounds a year, which is a great amount of money in that period. And this essentially makes her, to our knowledge, the first woman in Virginia history to hold a official position in the government. And so this is not necessarily something that is exceptional in the period, because there are so many women who are managing taverns, storehouses, shops, different businesses, oftentimes through the passing of their husbands, and then they inherit these businesses. But Clementine is really doing it to a pretty exceptional degree, beyond the kind of bounds which a lot of women are able to attain in that period. And she does this in a really skillful way, I think. So Clementina, at once, whilst clearly being ambitious in arguing that she's the individual to hold up this contract, which has been previously held by men, she at once shows her ambition, shows her capability to do that job, but also uses very deferent language when she writes in her newspaper, when she speaks to politicians of the day. She kind of speaks in this very gendered language, which really acts as a plea for support in some ways, and also often includes language which would revolve around the idea like, I hope I can fulfill the expectations of this post. And that's really important because she's doing very radical things, and she's doing things that push gendered expectations in the period, but she is also doing it in such a way that it kind of appears non-threatening to white men in the colony at the time. She does such a good job of straddling this line between pushing boundaries, being an ambitious individual. So this idea of nonpartisanship. Ultimately, Clementina, she prints that newspaper for around 13 months, I think. So it's very short-lived, her tenure. And although it does pick up on more revolutionary ideals as they become more popular in society in 1774, she's still balancing it with kind of counterpoints, and she's able to maintain a kind of largely unbiased view through that newspaper. So she doesn't necessarily create a target on her back in that way. She's well respected even by her competitors. And upon her death in September of 1774, her competitors are actually printing editorials which are praising her for her industry, her great enthusiasm for the work she did, and the ways in which she was able to kind of have this well-balanced paper that spoke to multiple sides and perspectives and didn't seem to be in the kind of thrall of one group or another.
In 1774, Clementina's path crosses with the work of a much more famous Virginian. Thomas Jefferson was too sick to attend the 1774 Virginia Convention in person, but that didn't stop him from participating. He wrote down his arguments against British rule, which we today know as a summary view of the rights of British America.
It actually quite suits Jefferson, and this is something important to think about when we think about orality and the written word in the 18th century, because Jefferson is well known as a very good writer. He's not so good as a speaker. And it's important to think that perhaps some of his messaging wouldn't have had the same power and effect if he did not have access to print culture and methods of mass communication and dissemination.
So Jefferson sends these resolutions by way of his enslaved waiting man, Jupiter. Patrick Henry and Peyton Randolph each get a copy, and they're read aloud during the convention. Thomas Jefferson argued that Parliament had no authority over the colonies and that colonial allegiance was a matter of choice, not obligation. To be frank, his ideas were too much for the convention at first. But there was a small group of more forward-thinking, more radical burgesses that actually thought they should get this material printed and disseminated for broader consumption by the public.
They consult none other than Clementina Rind, and they ask her to produce a short pamphlet that ultimately becomes known by its abbreviated name, A Summary View of the Rights of British North America. This is important because it essentially stands, many historians have said this, essentially stands as an early iteration of the Declaration of Independence. And the reason it does this is, in addition to listing many grievances against the British, putting forward ideas about liberty and free trade that Jefferson believes that the colonists are naturally entitled to, he goes beyond this kind of call for a pushback against Parliament's right to levy taxes on the colonists, and actually goes even further to say they have no authority over us whatsoever. And that obviously becomes a key tenet of independence and ultimately the Declaration of Independence. So this pamphlet is published in Williamsburg in August. It's a very humble looking pamphlet. It's threaded together with string, and it's very small, something like 30 or 40 pages long. And it travels at immense speeds up and down the eastern seaboard and actually across the Atlantic world. And it has this immense impact on the way that people think about the revolution, the kind of possibilities, what can be achieved by resistance to the British crown. And ultimately, I think one of the most exciting things about this document is it's printed in Clementina's printing shop in August. But 4 months later, there are second editions that are being published up and down the Eastern Seaboard, in Philadelphia, up in Massachusetts, but also in England as well, by English radicals who themselves have issues with the crown at the time. They begin to publish this.
Once knowledge or ideas get out there, you can't control where they go or who hears them. The momentum of Jefferson's rhetoric carries far beyond its intended audience of the small group of elite white men. It makes its way to loyalists, to enslaved people, to free Black people, to women. It makes its way to people across the 13 colonies and across the ocean.
The idea that a paper document, which is fairly humble looking in appearance, could have this kind of resonant impact across the Atlantic world. It actually has additions made to it in London. Arthur Lee, who's a Virginia radical living in London at the time, is believed to have anonymously added a kind of foreword to it, which heightens the sense of this almost like impending crisis with Britain. And so the idea that ultimately this document that establishes Thomas Jefferson's reputation, which stands as an early iteration of the Declaration of Independence, it's being disseminated, and all of those great things that come from it are being facilitated by the fact that it's Clementina Rind who gets the job to print this pamphlet and ultimately give it that huge circulation. It's Clementina Rind and her interventions which make her stand not just as a kind of passive supporter of revolutionary discourse and ideals, but as a facilitator of that discourse and someone who's really pushing it to its limits. It's that kind of humble pamphlet which ultimately gives rise or has a lineage with what is considered the most important document in American history and perhaps world history. We're really fortunate at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture to actually have one of those first issues of Clementina's Summary View of the Rights of British America. To my knowledge, there are less than 10 in existence in the entire world. But beyond that, we actually also have several other editions of the same publication. We have two of the London edition as well. So you can come to our collections and literally see that kind of bounce back of knowledge and communication as it emanated from Williamsburg and around the Atlantic world, and then ultimately ends up returning in a different form, strengthened, emphasized by the additions that are made to it in London as well.
Enslaved peoples heard these calls for liberty, which amplified questions about their own lives held in bondage and the hypocrisy of those that enslaved them.
It really does have multiple impacts. And in the same way that it sort of consolidates opinion on the patriot side, it's also going to essentially act as an alarm bell to people who are loyal to the British government. And of course, the role of the enslaved there. So often, this rhetoric is actually drawing on the language of slavery, the language of oppression and tyranny, because quite frankly, that's the world that these bleeding Virginian planters are living in, are immersed in, and are dependent upon themselves. So in drawing from their own life experiences and kind of hypocritically using the language of masters and slaves and enslavement and the lack of freedom and liberty, they're also giving a message to African Americans and Africans who have recently been brought into the colonies that this same language can be turned on its head and applied to their situation, right? So if we think about someone like Dick, then if he is working with a printing press, then clearly he's going to have some degree of literacy. It might not be literacy in the way that we conceive in the present day, but certainly he's able to read, write to some degree to be able to help in that process, right? So people like Dick are picking up this material, they're seeing public notices, they're also hearing conversations, and they are taking that knowledge and then disseminating it within their own communities as well. So when they go back to their families at night, they might pass on the messages that they've picked up from all these different pieces of print culture which are circulating in society. When they travel to a different plantation or perhaps go from a place like Williamsburg into the kind of frontier or those less populated areas, they're spreading that revolutionary sentiment in a way which is the ultimate fear of a lot of those Virginia planters. But they're able to kind of seize upon that revolutionary rhetoric and apply it to their own circumstances.
George Washington once said, "Liberty, when it begins to take root, is a plant of rapid growth." While this rhetoric wasn't intended to include enslaved individuals, it did plant seeds of resistance. And as Kathy explains, for many enslaved people, the promise of liberty became a tangible and immediate goal.
A lot of these men, like Jupiter, who are waiting men, are going to hear some of these conversations because they're going to be serving at dinner at Peyton Randolph's house when they're all talking. These were highly intelligent, highly skilled men who were with their enslavers pretty much 24/7. Because these men heard these conversations. They heard things in taverns and they're passing them along to their communities. And even though they don't have a direct vote or anything like that, they are passing along news. So they do know these things. In the summer of 74, it's hard for us to understand what they're thinking or what they're doing. However, in the fall of 75, when Dunmore issues his proclamation saying that any enslaved people, indentured servants, apprentices who come to me and will fight for me, you'll be free. They go in droves. Agricultural workers go, tradespeople go, waiting men go, along with women and children who also abscond. So this idea of freedom and liberty is making its way into the enslaved community, and they are taking it on board.
Revolutionary print culture wasn't just about what was on the page. It was about who read it, who discussed it, and who acted on it. The written word helped ignite a revolution, but it was the people who carried these words forward who made history.
There are so many parallels to the present, because although the means change, although the specific ways in which people are communicating these ideas might change, the words they're choosing to use, ultimately there are so many kind of foundational aspects that do just resonate into the present day.
The power of print was its ability to unify and mobilize. It gave Jefferson a platform, it spread Paine's radical call for independence, and it allowed printers like Clementina Rind to shape the revolutionary narrative. But print alone wasn't enough. It was in the taverns, the coffee houses, the streets, and the people where these ideas took root. That's it for today's episode of Revolution Revisited. In our next episode, we're diving into the First Continental Congress. A special thank you to James Herrera Brooks and Kathy Hellyer for sharing their expertise. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. For more episodes and resources, including the primary sources mentioned in this episode, check out our website at virginiahistory.org/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Don't miss your chance to see Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture before it closes on January 4th. This special exhibition commemorates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Discover Virginia's leading role in the American Revolution and how both iconic and everyday people helped forge a new nation. Tickets at virginiahistory.org.